Thanks for coming to the, what is the first of the Friday conversations for this year. As you know, last year we ran what we call Chronicle, which was more of a sort of private discussion which we recorded for that time. This year we thought we'd take a different tack and open these discussions up to anyone who's interested in coming along. So today we've got John Roth and Terry Bird, and we're going to have a conversation that sort of revolves, if you excuse the pun, around OSW's fantastic exhibition, Lumpen Falls. Terry being one third of the collaborative group OSW.
I apologise for the active spot. They're both teaching today, so they could be here.
And I'm not sure, John probably needs no introduction to some of you, but to others he's, I guess, the resident Deleuze expert in Melbourne, having written Badges, Deleuze, and has also put on many events at Melbourne Continental School of Philosophy. Is that correct? Just as a brief preface and to start, there's a couple of comments that sort of came to mind. I guess the first one, Terry, being something you wrote in an email recently about. Now, let me get this right. I've written down. The difficulty of rethinking understandings of matter through sculptural practice. I thought that was an interesting one to just sort of, hover there, if you like. And in experiencing the exhibition, thinking about those words, I guess I'm reminded of curator at large Hans Obrist's comment, and again I'll read it out. Art continues to be, for the large part, a story of objects. So I'll leave it there, and maybe there was one more thing I wanted to say. And that was, Terry, that you mentioned you thought it was interesting for the artist not to speak at first, but for perhaps the onlooker to respond, because the artist is often thinking that they're doing things that they're not.
Well, particularly because I think it's the material operations of the work that are the work, so to have somebody else respond to those.
Sure.
Well, so John, you've had a little bit of time with this.
I have to admit, most philosophers, if they are honest with themselves, realise that they're a bit of idiots or honest with respect to art. You know, that philosophers tend to be fairly crude in their way of thinking about art, or overly categorical, I guess, kind of a massive theoretical edifice that they impose on them. So I'm personally quite taken with Jean-François Picard's approach to artwork. He says often people invite me to write something, and I don't really have anything to say to this artwork. He says of some artwork that the best you can do sometimes is to say, well, look at that. I'm deeply sympathetic with that, I'd say that first of all. At the same time, I'm a philosopher who's interested in objects primarily, and that's really what I could call myself, something that would be what it is, a philosopher of objects. And also Terry and I have been in dialogue for, 6 months or something, a little bit around some of the questions that I guess you'd say at the intersection between art and philosophy in general. And of course, Terry's also an amazing theorist of art. So I'm really the third wheel here, really. I can consider myself the sounding board as well. So I guess I'd preface anything I have to say by saying those things. Well, let's talk about some objects, then, shall we?
Yeah.
The first thing that struck me as I looked at all this is that, with an interesting exception of this one, they're all machine based in certain respects. Mechanisms of the research. Is that at all relevant to what you were doing?
I guess. It was this play of forces and materials, so I guess the machine comes into that.
Sure.
Yeah. This central one is obviously something that's activated by the viewer rather than by animated by some mechanical device.
Although the ball over there seems to me to be responding to me when I first started
Well, I don't. It does actually
move. Yeah. Oh yeah, I saw it. Like, yeah. It was just after I was watching it, and so I felt like maybe I understood. In general, some sort of motion in it. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know what it wants exactly, but it wants something.
Yeah, it's a sporadic movement. And quite a few viewers have commented that they thought it was a sleight of hand, some type of trick. Maybe even there was something wrong with their eyes. But the pauses are so long
as to
lull you into a sense of stillness. What I like about it is that the movement is quite effortless.
Right.
It does somehow enact the difficulty. The lumping qualities of actually shifting itself.
Yeah.
A duration of force matter combinations is one of the things we're really trying to kind of evoke. And all of these durations, beyond the kind of humans.
I wonder what you think about rhythm and repetition.
Well, it's an interesting question.
Certainly something that I think that the exhibition evokes.
Sure it is.
It's true, it happens.
Yeah. I think that's an excellent question. Actually, to me, it comes back to something that's in the material, the written material that we show. The thing about rhythm for me is that it's something that rhythm's only rhythm if it's habitually. People traumatized it. If it's not something you can make sense of, it's not rhythmic at all. It's struggling. I feel like this thing is. When you watch the tennis balls in the briefing, you notice there's a beautiful rhythm to it, and it's kind of lolling around. The word merry comes upon it, and it's done everything. But this, on the other hand, is laborious, and angry. The thing that struck me was that in the notes of the show, you emphasise something I think is very important. Art has the ability to interrupt, create a space for the rethinking of these things. And I think the arrhythmic, I can put it this way, the arrhythmic nature of art is to me one of the crucial things about breaking down visual relations, perceptual habits, perceptual rhythms. And also intellectual rhythms, when you're confronted with something you don't understand, you're forced to go back and learn again how to think about these things. I think that's important as well.
One of the comments you made about the essay that I've written on Fiona's work was the trouble of matter always being the thing that moves.
Yeah.
In making this exhibition and the previous.
Right.
I'm not sure we can.
No.
But I'm curious to know what you said
about it. Well, I think, for reasons related to that, this is my favourite piece of this master. Aside from my, let's say, fixation with celestial bodies at the moment, the fact that it is so still, it's so alluring to me. I don't know what else to say about that. I've learned now about this. I'll come back to it later on. I wonder, certainly in the history of Western thought, there's been a relationship between motion and matter. These two things have been bound together. The other inanimate matter is a phrase that people kick around, but in fact, it's kind of an impossibility for most of the traditional Western thought. So to be engaged with investigating its possibility, thinking about it, trying in a way to invoke it, is, I think, really important and really interesting. And what's strange about that is, of course, that most traditional art is being immobile in a certain sense. In the traditional art is immobile. And yet, it doesn't have the same kind of mobility as this. So before you said, there's no real boundary between painting and sculpture. And I think one of the differences to me is that the immobility of sculpture is something that's foregrounded in a way, isn't it? At least with me. There's colour rhythms that are involved in it. Yeah, which seem, have always seemed to me, anyway, to be at the forefront of my engagement with painting. here you just confront it, you know, here is this still thing.
I think the thing that we love about that object is that it's so dense, and in that density it seems to contract all of its history, which is vaster than what we can perceive. And also, it looks so much like it's been modelled by hand, and yet every mark on its surface when we took the mold is formed by its passage here.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, but we cast it in the plasticine. In the hope that it will continue to be molten because people touch it and stuff like that. But I think that's why it's such a captivating object, because it really just contracts.
And the temporal qualities of that too. Yeah. We think about the, you know, the hand of the artist as an index of the time.
Yeah.
We think of the hand of those forces, if you like, we're stretching out from the concept of that framework. When I look at the object, I can't help but also read the rod and the nut that holds it to the top as part of, or an expression of, its immobility, of perhaps the difficulty of representing the prior history of this, of the object that this represents.
It suspends it, but it keeps it, locates it in a very concrete way.
Very much so. In the thinking about this type of infrastructure does clearly have the exhibition.
We're not into pretending that things are just, levitating off the ground, but it is very much a part of the work, and the same with the frame of, that suspends the paper.
Yeah, it takes me back to that word difficulty, and whether there is a sort of an attempt to honestly express that difficulty. That difficulty of representing matter through sculpture.
Yeah, although I would never use the word represent. The difficulty of activating it, or, the difficulty of trying to rethink it as something that doesn't represent. It's something that produces effects.
I think that's really key, That's really important. I mean, I think that comes back to the contraction idea as well. The fact that so much time is contracted into these things, also what makes them so moving as well. In a sense, it looks like you're confronting something now. As you say, I think by activating a connection with a passage of time, a contraction of matter that's so vast, I think that's moving, it's being confronted with that reality. Mm-hmm. Maybe this thing, not only this thing, but the other thing that is related to it, has a rhythm, but its rhythms are so vast compared to our own, it throws our own into the deep. The rhythm of being alive, of seeing it, of moving around it.
Terry, did you want to mention your comment about painting sculpture, but also perhaps that interest in you had in talking about with the artist Fontana, this idea of impact, resilience, surface, the continuum of how do we pass through a surface or pierce that surface. That seems to be as much an idea that stems from the history of painting as it does from the sculpture.
Yes. I guess it comes about from supervising Andrea, who's a painter, and our endless conversations about the relationship between painting and sculpture, and particularly the way that she approaches painting is very much about... it's very much about the surface effects, and that's a lot of what goes on with these works as well, which makes me think, what's, the surface of the green ball, the surface of this form, the surface of the grey plasticine and the lead and the pink, the gold object, the surface is the point at which the materiality of the object is activated in a way. and so I have, you know, like, this, rather than there being this distinction between pain and sculpture, is it more this continuum of surface activation? And so that, you know, the surface activation of a painting is just a similar operation to the surface activation of an object, because a painting is an object as well. So it's a way of not being confined, perhaps, by the frame of the painting as the primary theme.
You certainly got a sense of that in the job with the tennis ball.
Yeah.
Was not able to pierce his surface.
Yeah, that's right.
But you think of that sort of resilience of an object, being able to absorb and digest its impact.
That would be one definition of an object, surely, is that something that can resist other objects. Mm-hmm. Anything that can sort out, you know, no longer exists as an object. But, I mean, there seemed to be an accommodation, I have to say, between the tennis ball and the room. Mm-hmm. You know, but that was a... It's not a violent kind of effect. I don't think so. Well, it wasn't for me anyway. It was a kind of a gathering, accepting. It sounds crazy to say. Yeah.
Philippa made the comment that she thought the broom ball registered the impact, which I thought was an interesting way of thinking about it. But I also feel like, you know, the broom ball, it's kind of, there's something brutal about it.
That's true.
Which, you know, it's a certain kind of violence to that.
But I think, again, the rhythm recuperates some of that violence. So you get used to that kind of... becomes a bit soothing, I think, in a way. For me, anyway.
And in a similar fashion, the pink work... It takes a little while, but you soon understand that it's paper, and you understand the lightness of those gestures. And, you know, in thinking about Fontana, I'm thinking about cut. I'm thinking about, you know, the dramatic, sort of, you know, surgical, like, cut through a piece of material. And that's not what's Is that knowing? Is that something that you enter into a sort of post manner, or is it just something? Is it just a material outcome?
I guess we're interested in, you know, Fontana as an artist, not so much the work that he's best known for, which are those slash paintings, but particularly his objects and his early ceramic works, because of the way he activates the surface, and also in his spatialist manifestos, the way he talked about art needing to continually renew the means of its expression. I'm not sure if that's the word he uses, but that sense of needing to continually renew its means, and he experimented with, you know, radio broadcasts and, you know, quiet centric processes for the 40s and 50s. He did this installation where he used phosphorescent paint and ultraviolet light in 49 to make this quite immersive installation, which, you know, is a precursor of a lot of practices that follow. So, you know, I mean, we have a long interest in his work in terms of that activation of surface, and also what Yves Alivoire refers to as his radical materiality, which he pitches against, you know, Greenberg's critique of kitsch as opposed to modernism, which, you know, Dominic Redfern on Friday night referred to the golf ball as the Frère Roger object, which we thought was fabulous. You know, couldn't be more kitsch.
I mean, there is a certain hokiness, if I could use that word, about some of it. You know, and when we go back to that term, wanton, I think there was a little mixed response on the open night as to whether that was a very sort of knowing conceit, or whether it comes through, say, in the doing. But, you know, this is a very calculated form of this bold ball on the front of it.
Yeah.
And very much evidence of the artist's hand.
And I can't remember why we came up with the mobile, but when we did, we just thought, what a great idea. Nobody makes mobiles anymore. They're so daggy, you know. And it was good to kind of try to reactivate that as a sculptural form. to see what you can do with it.
But a rather agricultural mobile. A mobile that no one feels like they can sort of manipulate and move around at will.
Yeah.
And a mobile that is completely immobile in the face of wind or breezes. So it's again, I come back to that sort of lumpen quality of how do things soar through space whilst we're so grounded.
But I guess that's part of wanting to suggest these different kinds of passages, different durations.
I mean, also, it reminded me of the famous statue of justice, holy to statues. Without justice. The way up. Since we're speaking about objects, I mean, this is clearly the least objecty thing here, right? The least lumpen-like as well,
yep.
In many respects. I mean, in terms of its form.
Yeah. I guess we wanted to add that to kind of reiterate the sort of what the meteorite is about and how that kind of activates the thinking of the other objects. Yeah. And particularly that, you know, not being from a human perspective, this movement through space.
That reiteration again plays into what I before about repetition.
Yes.
Differences and same differences that you need to occur throughout the show. Is that something that you...
Well, I think repetition is a funny thing, you know. It's a lot more complicated concept, complicated thing to think about, and also to use your accurate when you might first appear, you know. Because I think, as I said before, our habits, our way of seeing the world, is good at recuperating things which are ourselves. So, we all know this from seeing over and over again famous artworks or paintings, you know. We have no trouble recuperating into works that were once shocking, which is, you know, the return to the world of art, is that it's modern term, you know, it's only the term of effect. So to me, the issue of repetition has to be, you talk about it in each of these cases in different ways, I think. And this is interesting because, again, this is a little, somewhat.
It's a little funny down in the
bottom. Right. And yeah, it's so disorienting, in fact, that you could, you know, I don't know about anybody else, it makes me queasy if I stick too close to the wall if you're unwell. But I don't think you could recuperate this eventually and feel good about it. You could feel like it was normal because it's upsetting so many things that we think of as human, basic human modes of perception. The relationship between the ground and the horizon, your position of your body, and this is taking that away.
As part of that, you know, circularity, and it's perhaps a vehicle expressing reiteration through, I mean, both in terms of performance, it's circles everywhere, and in terms of, you know, the experience of going around in a circle through the video, but just in how things are reiterated, they compound, they keep evolving, and it's growing and snowballing as things go on.
Yeah. I think one of the first things we started off talking about as a group was to think about objects whose form wasn't determined by gravity, and the tennis ball was, or the ball was one of the things we first thought of, and that's when we first worked with the tennis ball machines and did that project at Clubs.
Yes.
Because it was one of the few objects that's form isn't determined by gravity. So we had this long interest in gravity and its effects on form. So yeah, there's certainly an endless reiteration that's been through a number of our projects about.
So form itself is produced in coming together of matter and time, if you like.
And it was, well, you know, many objects respond to the fact that there's gravity. They have faces, they sit on the ground, you know.
Sure.
And it was really hard to think of objects that weren't determined like that.
Well, almost all of them are, of course, including this one, right?
Yeah. Although, you see, that is formed by gravity, because it's gravity that draws it into the atmosphere of the Earth, and then it's that passage through the atmosphere that causes it to heat up, and it gets, you know, that moulding on the surface is from that heating up and the iron melting.
Sure. But before that, of course, it was hanging around.
Yeah, colliding with other asteroids. Right.
Why is it painted the way it is?
It's made out of plasticine, and that's the colour that the plasticine made when we cast it.
It's part of that reiteration region theory of works, given that many of these works have been made at various times and been exhibited in various configurations. Can you continue to extrapolate that out to your practice as a whole in terms of how you deal with objects in installation?
Well, you know, we've got that diagram that maps our practice, and in the middle of last year, we used that to generate an article as a way of thinking about the different connections between those images. And then out of that came, you know, this focus on the meteorite. So, yeah, there is this kind of falling in of interests that then open out to different fields. The green ball we've used before, the tennis ball machine, they, you know, they're connected to this thing about gravity, which is where the meteorite comes from, and then, you know, it kind of opens out and gets extrapolated to something else. And a lot of this work was shown in Adelaide, which was a completely different kind of space, and the tennis ball machine was much more central in it, activated a lot of the objects rather than just the ball. And that was more a focus between the matter-force relation, whereas this time we wanted to focus more on the temporal, durational aspect of it. So, yeah, you know, I guess each project is in the, continuation of something along a certain or around a certain group of interests.
So it's interesting because the material world seems to somehow sort of ebb and flow around that diagram. It seems to be the continuum. And there's that sort of interesting paradox in the practice between what remains sort of fixed despite being fluid. And then the exhibition itself, with its objects in space, become more than the ephemeral.
But then the diagram responds.
In turn.
John, is there any
other? Well, there are plenty of things to say, obviously. We'll talk about it.
Terry, you mentioned the essay. I was wondering what points you wanted to take up or discuss with John about that essay.
I read it this morning.
Did you? Well, it was, you know, his questioning about the capacity of matter to not just be the thing that changes, to have this active capacity. I guess, you know, that's what I was trying to argue, that matter is the thing that conveys the idea that it always has some active capacity that you work with. And I think there was also something about the spatial in that essay, the new question too.
Well, to be honest, the essay question me more than anything. I got my email to it as well. I really opposed a series of questions whether matter is thinkable per se. And then a philosophical question. Whether it's always that thing which proceeds in front of you and you're trying to grasp. Which again, that's why I think that the gap that art creates in our visual relationship to the world is so important, because it's possible that you can have that it can emerge for us.
You're also concerned that you lose the radical
difference. Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are a few different things. One of them is, as human beings, are we capable of treating those things? And that's where I can honestly approach them in a areas. The other is, the force responds us. Deleuze loves his line, and we don't yet know what we can do. Nothing we've experienced can tell us what we can do. This is true of all bodies, not just human bodies. We don't know what a meteorite is capable of from experience. In fact, I don't know, neither does a meteorite from experience point of view, because there's this potential that there can always be modulated in a variety of different ways. The reason why I find this particularly so moving in a way is because it confronts me with these kind of questions. The way it withdraws from me, it doesn't tell me anything, give me anything, it doesn't please me, or amuse me in some of the ways that the others come to me. I become the one who's challenged. The object is present and becomes a question for me. As a philosopher, but also as someone who is looking at this. So maybe I could say this to summarise my response. Those questions aside, maybe matter is distinguishable, but maybe it can be activated or encountered in a way that doesn't lend itself to any further theoretical investigation. In that absolute sense of
being. What do you mean it doesn't come out?
It resists, yeah. Matter resists, I guess. That would be my starting point. It resists perception. You can't see what's inside it. We can't know what will happen to it. Mm-hmm. We can't know what happened to it, ultimately. Objects always withdraw. It's a great thing we find in Heidegger, for example, that whatever object you happen to be using, if you're using a hammer, and you're using it as a hammer, and all the other things that it could be is in the background, hammer breaks, suddenly it appears to you as just too thin to handle this piece of metal. At the same time, all of the other usefulness of the hammer is gone in the background as well. So you never have the hammer in its entirety at any point. When you're using it, all of it's broken. This is an insight that's sort of being developed in this kind of philosophy, an object-oriented philosophy. That objects have a reality of their own beyond any one way of existing. You could be a doorstop, it could be a weapon, it could be something they bred on. In fact, the things that the object is capable of doing as a body are unlimited. We can't even know what they all are. We, on the other hand, have a pretty good sense of what we're capable of. Not being able to fly out the window, eat too much chili, or drink too much whiskey. Objects confront us. This object confronts us with the fact that we can't be like that. The limits to how we are at the moment, which are all we have in our lives.
We have limits with objects.
Absolutely.
And make us the one after making us feel how we are able to do
this.
And that means also capacity. I mean, that's something that does.
Yes.
Any interpretations can never completely capture the world. So, how is the art object different from ordinary objects?
That's an interesting question. What do you think?
Well, I think it's because they're not dictated by instrumental means, and so that they have that capacity to open up to the things that are perceptible. The unknowable, the unknown.
A very Kantian answer, I think.
Isn't it?
Sure.
Free to function?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, not the time. Like the chairs in the shop downstairs,
Nonetheless, those objects can be turned into.
But isn't that complex? And that's a good complex.
Yes, but surely partly too. But we know that the meteorite, it's possible for it to be an artwork. There's one thing they can do.
We can set up a
I mean, you could, that's right. So it's more like, it's less that art is limited, but there's always another art possible. There's always another one, another brain in such a way.
Run a sheet.